Now, as regular listeners will know, every Sunday around this time here on Times Radio, we try to ask one of the big political questions of the week. And this week, following Tony Blair's re-entry in the political fray and his interview with Times Radio, he says he doesn't understand the logic behind net zero being enforced on UK taxpayers while the rest of the world continues to dig up oil. So this week we're asking, is it time for a change in the net zero policy? And joining me to answer that question is Claire Perry-O'Neill, formerly a Conservative Energy Minister, now Managing Director for Climate and Energy at the World Business Council. And she's actually writing a book on corporate courage and climate realism. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Adam. Nice to see you again.
Now, we were hoping to have Dale Vince debating with you, but he's unable to do that. He's feeling unwell. What do you say to the claims made by Ed Miliband and indeed this government that they are forward-thinking, that the future has to be renewable energy, and that therefore in the long term it's good for the British economy to invest in that?
So look, I feel very involved in this because I actually bought in the net zero legislation that committed the country to this 2050 as a legal target. And I sort of understand intellectually Ed's point. Ed is very courageous on this. He's one of the few ministers who's come back to the same brief. And he's done that thing called establishing the Overton principle, which is you shift the debate to we are going to be net zero. We are going to be entirely purist about this. And in some ways, that's a coherent argument. And, you know, if you talk to international companies around the world, they see the UK as somewhere with relatively stable, low carbon policies. It's a good place to invest. The problem is, first of all, we should never have bought in the net zero 2050 legislation. And I'll say more about that. Hopefully you'll have me back to talk about that when the book's published. Because committing the country to a long-term legislated target is a bit nuts. No country's ever done that for a GDP target, for example. Secondly, we genuinely had no idea, I think, how difficult and costly this was going to be. And I have to say, with great respect and affection for the Climate Change Committee, full of great people, the analysis was poor, and nobody, for example, spoke out at the, you know, and asked the Treasury, can we actually afford this? And lastly, the world has changed dramatically since those kind of heady pre-COP 26 days. Energy supply is weaponized, energy demand has exploded given the rise of AI. And we've now really started to sharpen our pencils on the cost of this transition. I think that decarbonizing the world over the long term is a good thing because you can't cheat atmospheric physics. A warmer world is going to be a wilder world, and it will fall very disproportionately on the poorest and the least able to resist, partly because their governments aren't terribly organized. But we have got to be much more clear-eyed and realistic about how we deliver this over the long term. And in particular, this fight over North Sea oil and gas is slightly ridiculous, because on the one hand, you know, we talk about, well, we don't want those emissions in the UK's emissions balance. Well, they're not. Governments do not account for the downstream effect of burning the oil and gas they produce. And the emissions that those platforms produce is about 3% of the total of the UK's total emissions. And that could drop dramatically if we electrified those platforms. Secondly, as we've heard, the other side of the North Sea basin, Norway, Equinor, are producing incredible results for the Norwegian economy from their current drilling and are continuing to invest. And what we're finding is this notion that there's no oil and gas left in the North Sea is completely ridiculous. The Anders Uppel, the Equinor CEO, is on the record saying, this is a huge growth industry. We're re-drilling wells. We're finding oil and gas that we need. And it seems very perverse to me to be then re-importing that gas through pipelines. Norway's a great, reliable neighbor of ours, as we know, but it just seems a bit odd. So I know, again, why Ed is doing this. And again, I have great respect for him. It's part of this incredible consistency. You know, the UK has led the world in industrial decarbonization, partly because we offshored a lot of it, and he wants to be seen as a global leader in this space. But now the game is, where can we get every possible molecule and electron from? And we need everything. We need gas, we need nuclear, we need biomass, and we need renewables, and we need a transmission system. Now, so I have to say, I think Tony Blair is right on this one.
Okay, now, just on the question of the legislation you introduced, the net zero legislation, I mean, that was part of an international movement, wasn't it? The Paris Accords, the various climate change meetings, a commitment which we entered into. I mean, are you saying we should never have entered into those commitments? Because everyone else did as well.
Well, so to be careful, so the Paris Agreement, which set out these temperature limits of 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees of warming, the lower end of that, the 1.5 degrees, is what drives the net zero by 2050. And again, I'll write about this. It is an entirely political construct. Even at the time of the Paris Agreement, people were saying this is completely unachievable. And we're already at or around 1.5 degrees of warming. The reason we introduced it, if I'm truthful, as you may remember, I had a big role to play in COP26 in Glasgow. We wanted that to be a net zero COP, and there was a view that our position as the president would be enhanced by this legislation. And Prime Minister May and I and the team were advised that this was doable. It was relatively affordable. It would be about 2% of total GDP, much less than the defense budget, was the argument. And I'm sort of, you know, looking back, we had all swallowed the Kool-Aid. And it seemed, and also remember this, Adam, politicians think about the next election. They don't think about 30-year emissions levels. Ed is one of the few that does. And so, as we all know, I'm now back in the private sector, it's relatively easy to sign up to these things and then move on. And any law can be changed, as we've seen with many of the laws we brought in then. Okay. So I think we ought to reframe it, and we certainly should not be on an all-out push that is ruling out activities that are actually helpful to the economic growth story.
Right. You've made your position clear on North Sea. What about renewables, though? Because as I understand it, the key burden of on individuals that Ed Miliband has imposed is basically taxing them to invest in renewables, and a suggestion that, frankly, we are overpaying for the renewables, which we're installing partly because half the time we can't consume the energy they're producing. So do we need a total rethink there?
No. So again, I'm sorry to come overall energy ministerial on you, but so the high costs we pay for our energy bills have relatively little to do with the renewable subsidy regime. They have a lot to do with the fact that we price our energy system off the capacity, off the kind of marginal bit, which is gas. Gas is extremely useful. We should have gas for a lot longer, but we shouldn't be pricing our entire energy regime off gas. Renewables are a great way of improving your energy security. And actually, our offshore wind investment, again, which I was very involved in, is a wonderful way of exploiting.
Yeah, but half the time it's switched off and we're still paying for it.
Well, that curtailment stuff, well, then that's nonsense, as is also the fact that we still haven't built.
Well, I'm quoting Jeremy Hunt there.
Well, we don't have a good grid connection still, many years after bringing this forward. This is all underway. Storage can help us with that. So the big shift now is to have renewables with storage so that you can actually absorb it when you don't need it and put it back in the grid. But it is a fallacy to us to think that you can ever run a grid off 100% renewables, even with battery storage in an industrialized economy. And again, anyone who is an energy expert will tell you this. And we have these endless debates about, oh, well, we don't really need nuclear. We don't really need biomass. Yes, we do, because they give us incredibly reliable baseload. And also, we need everything. Energy demand is soaring around the world, and it should be soaring here. We should be trying to attract these high energy consuming new industries of the future and make the UK a great place for them.
Claire Perry O'Neill, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. We'll speak to you again, I'm sure.
Hopefully.